Hello and welcome to Sound Body, a weekly program of information on health topics and ideas that can help you live life to its fullest. I'm Louise Craig. The statistics on opioid injury and death in the U.S. are very frightening. A young man I know spent 3 weeks in hospital recuperating from an overdose that resulted in paralysis of the right side of his body. As he should, he feels lucky not to have died. Currently, opioid overdoses are the leading cause of injury death in the U.S. That's more than car crashes. I just find that incredible and incredibly sad. In a better late than never fashion, doctors and pharmaceutical companies are finally looking to interventions other than opioids for acute and chronic pain. From the magazine Scientific American Mind, we are going to read the article Rethinking Relief, written by Stephanie Sutherland and published in the May-June 2017 issue. The United States is in the grip of an unprecedented public health crisis, one in which well-meaning doctors have played a part. Between 1999 and 2014, sales of prescription opioid drugs nearly quadrupled. In 2012 alone, physicians issued 259 million opioid prescriptions, enough to give a bottle of pills to every adult in the country. And in 2015, more than half of all overdose deaths in the U.S. involved opioids, either pain medications such as OxyContin and Vicodin, or illicit substances such as opium and heroin. To put that statistic in perspective, opioids claimed roughly as many lives that year as car crashes. Addiction is undoubtedly part of the problem, but experts now agree that the real driver behind the opioid epidemic is chronic pain. According to a landmark study published in 2011 by the Institute of Medicine, an estimated 100 million American adults live with persistent or chronic pain. Many rely on opioids just to keep moving. There is no question that these drugs provide the best defense against acute short-term pain, which alerts us to an injury or disease and subsides during recovery. But chronic pain is fundamentally different. It lingers long after an injury is healed and can produce a variety of symptoms, from headaches to body aches to crippling fatigue. It may stem from an underlying condition, such as osteoarthritis or multiple sclerosis, or have no obvious source. For some, chronic pain begins with nerve damage from diabetes, chemotherapy, a virus, a car accident, or some other insult. In these cases, injured nerve fibers mistakenly continue to send pain signals to the brain, causing what is known as neuropathic pain. No matter how chronic pain starts, it often increases and spreads, leaving many people reaching for more pills. Unfortunately, higher doses of opioid drugs do not guarantee relief and can actually make matters worse. For starters, patients build tolerance to these medications so that over time it takes more opioids to blunt the same levels of pain. Higher doses increase the risk of dangerous side effects, including addiction, coma, and death. And recent research shows that even relatively low doses of opioids can also cause hyperalgesia, or an increased sensitivity to pain. Sometimes these drugs intensify the very pain they are meant to suppress. For these reasons, a significant number of chronic pain sufferers eventually find themselves caught in a delicate and deadly balancing act. They need to take more opioid medications to keep their disabling pain in check, while somehow dodging the drug's serious and life-threatening side effects. Some succeed for decades, but those who lose their footing are flooding emergency rooms and hospital beds, battling withdrawal, accidental overdose, and a host of other opioid-related complications. Last year, medical authorities began to respond on several fronts. In March 2016, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention issued stricter guidelines for prescribing opioids. Contrary to what has been common practice, it advised against treating chronic pain with these drugs unless the benefits clearly outweigh the risks. Surgeon General Vivek H. Murthy amplified that message 5 months later when he wrote directly to all the nation's healthcare providers, the first time any Surgeon General has done so, urging 2.3 million professionals to commit to turn the tide on the opioid crisis. Around the same time, the Food and Drug Administration required stronger warning labels on all opioid medications. The Department of Health and Human Services joined the fray by issuing a new national pain strategy, emphasizing the need for greater prevention, safer drugs, and broader approaches to treatment. The message is being heard. At a handful of state-of-the-art pain centers around the country, clinicians are exploring a range of non-drug alternatives, from psychological interventions to complementary therapies. Researchers are also working on next-generation opioid drugs, along with new non-opioid painkillers. These initiatives represent the one upside to the opioid crisis. It's forcing us to revisit how we care for people in pain, says Sean Mackey, who heads the Pain Management Center at Stanford University and co-chaired the committee of experts from multiple U.S. agencies that developed the new HHS strategy. I'm not pro-opioid, I'm not anti-opioid, I'm pro-patient, he says. There will be no magic bullet, no pill. Chronic pain requires multi-pronged treatment. In August 2016, David, and the patient's names have been changed to protect their privacy, a former school worker wheeled himself into pain psychologist Beth Darnall's office at the Stanford Pain Clinic, one of the nation's few multidisciplinary pain centers. He and his wife had traveled for 3 hours that morning from their home by medical transport. David had undergone minor surgery on his right foot just one day before and was still wearing a hospital-issued blue paper bootie. But nothing was going to stop him from keeping this appointment, which he had waited weeks to get. Darnell started by taking a detailed medical history. David described ongoing pain in his back and body, which had started in 1995, the last time he had felt well enough to work full-time. That year had been devastating for him medically. He had contracted meningitis from a tick bite and was diagnosed with cancer. The diseases plus chemotherapy had ravaged his nerves, causing constant pain, which led to further challenges, both physical and psychological. Many experts now view chronic pain as a disease in its own right. Over time, it engages and changes patterns of activity in brain areas associated not only with physical sensations, but with sleep, thought, and emotion. No wonder that studies show that chronic pain is associated with higher rates of mortality, sleep disorders, depression, and anxiety. For 20 years, David had been taking ever-escalating doses of opioid drugs, including methadone, a long-acting opioid painkiller, and fast-acting Dilaudid, occasionally supplemented with Demerol, yet another opioid. But in addition, he depended on Valium to tamper his anxiety and Ambien to help him sleep. For most people, this drug cocktail would be deadly. For David, it had become a daily routine. Darnell listened to David's story and then asked if anyone had ever spoken to him about how dangerous this drug combination was. No, he replied, although he did have firsthand experience. On 3 separate occasions, he had been rushed to the hospital near death. This is really the only tool you've ever been given to cope with the pain, Darnell explained, and we need to replace it. David is far from alone. According to a Washington Post Kaiser Family Foundation survey conducted last fall, among people taking prescription painkillers for at least 2 months, about a third said they did not receive information about the dangers of opioids from their doctor. Only a third said their doctor had outlined a plan to wean them off the drugs. And another third reported that their doctor had never discussed any complementary treatments beyond medications. to treat people more effectively will require an important shift in how we think about pain, says David Shurtleff, Deputy Director of the National Center for Complementary and Integrative Health, NCCIH, the part of the National Institutes of Health that studies non-drug therapies. We now understand that pain is not just a sensation, but a brain state, Shurtleff explains, and mind-body interventions may be particularly helpful. The team at Stanford brings together pain psychologists such as Darnell, pain management physicians, psychiatrists, neurologists, anesthesiologists, physical and occupational therapists, and nurse practitioners, who collaborate to help patients safely reduce their use of opioids and replace them with non-drug alternatives. The team members meet every week to fine-tune evolving treatment plans that might incorporate cognitive behavioral therapy, CBT, physical therapy, mindfulness training, yoga, biofeedback, and acupuncture. Above all, it is a customized approach to suit the individual patient. For David, the plan started with an inpatient stay to safely and significantly reduce his dependence on opioid medications. At the same time, Darnell homed in on his anxiety, referring David to a local psychologist for talk therapy after discharge and prescribing a guided relaxation regimen using a CD. "Your anxiety makes the pain worse," she explained at the conclusion of his initial visit. "If we can focus on tools to stop the anxiety, that can help shrink the pain." Taking such a broad approach is neither simple nor cheap, and better insurance coverage of non-drug therapies will be needed to make it a widely practical. But experts such as Mackey say the complexity of chronic pain warrants it. Perhaps the complementary therapy that has garnered the most attention in recent years is mindfulness-based stress reduction, MBSR, a clinical and secular adaptation of Buddhist meditation practices. Jon Kabat-Zinn, now a professor of medicine emeritus at the University of Massachusetts Medical School, developed MBSR in the 1970s. Since then, MBSR classes have cropped up in every U.S. state and in more than 30 countries. A growing body of evidence suggests that MBSR, which encourages non-judgmental awareness of the present moment and fosters greater mind-body awareness, can mitigate a variety of ailments, from cancer and depression to drug addiction and chronic pain. In 2016, Senior Investigator Emeritus Daniel C. Churkin of the Group Health Research Institute in Seattle and his colleagues tested three treatments for chronic low back pain in 342 young and middle-aged adults. MBSR, cognitive behavioral therapy, designed to change pain-related thoughts and behaviors, and standard pain care. They found that compared with participants who received standard pain care, more patients receiving MBSR or CBT showed a significant drop in pain bothersomeness after 26 weeks. In addition, the MBSR and CBT groups improved more in their functional abilities. Other chronic pain sufferers are making gains with biofeedback, using sensors to monitor bodily signals such as muscle tension and heart rate. They build awareness of physiological processes and learn to modulate their own pain. A 2017 meta-analysis evaluated biofeedback for chronic back pain in 1,062 patients and found that it not only lowered pain intensity, but also improved patients' coping abilities and reduced the incidence of pain-related depression. Mackey and others have also tested a more sophisticated technique called neurofeedback, which provides patients with images of their own brain activity using electroencephalography or functional MRI. This kind of training can teach patients to control brain regions associated with pain processing. Additional evidence suggests that acupuncture might help ease chronic pain in some cases. Perhaps, some scientists speculate, by stimulating anti-inflammatory signals in the skin or influencing activity deep in the brain. The practice remains controversial, in part because it is difficult to study. but a 2014 analysis of 29 clinical trials of acupuncture for chronic pain in nearly 18,000 patients showed that compared with treatment with no needles or misplaced needles, the traditional form, with needles placed according to centuries-old Chinese practice, produced greater pain relief. At the same time, a significant number of people in the control groups also saw benefits, suggesting a strong placebo effect. That finding reinforces the idea that when it comes to pain, simply being under the care of a receptive healthcare professional can be palliative. Researchers are investigating how all these complementary treatments work, but we are not waiting for basic science to tell us the optimal way to treat pain, Shurtleff says. There is broad agreement that mindfulness, yoga, biofeedback, and acupuncture may succeed by changing patients' relationship to their pain rather than actually lowering the intensity of the physical sensation. At the NCCIH, Shurtleff and others are trying to figure out how to best apply existing complementary treatments. Patients are suffering, and we want to find what really works. We take that pragmatic approach, he says. The NCCIH recently conducted an extensive review of published clinical trials for a variety of complementary therapies with the aim of finding out which treatments might work best for which patients. It found that acupuncture and yoga benefited people with chronic back pain the most. Acupuncture and Tai Chi proved most helpful for those with chronic pain resulting from osteoarthritis. Massage therapy provided short-term benefits for neck pain, and relaxation techniques were most effective in those with severe headaches and migraines. There is another reason why individualized care makes sense for chronic pain. Different people can experience the same kind of pain in very different ways. In particular, researchers are discovering that how much chronic pain affects any one person depends heavily on so-called biopsychosocial factors. How someone reacts to pain emotionally, what other sources of stress exist, how much social support surrounds the person. Targeting these influences can not only reduce patients' experience of pain, but dramatically improve their quality of life. Indeed, chronic pain-related disabilities often leave people isolated and cut off from friends, which can in turn make the pain more intense. To identify biopsychosocial factors up front, patients at the Stanford Clinic fill out an extensive online questionnaire, capturing everything from work histories and adverse childhood experiences to sleep habits and anger levels. Mackie believes that collecting this type of data holds the key to matching patients with effective treatments. The questionnaire is part of a free, open-source repository that he and his colleagues at Stanford have created, together with researchers at the NIH. The system, called the Collaborative Health Outcomes Information Registry, or QIRE, is now in use at medical centers around the U.S., and soon will be in several other countries. It contains data from more than 15,000 patients. Healthcare providers can use the system to track patients' progress over time and to compare their trajectories with similar cases. This data set has revealed that one factor in particular, a mindset called catastrophizing, predicts the impact of chronic pain on a person's life far better than any other measure. At its core, catastrophizing is a tendency to exaggerate or magnify the threat of pain, to fear the worst and remain focused on the experience of pain. For people trapped in this way of thinking, their pain feels overwhelming. They hold little hope that they will ever be well again. That leads to a very strong desire to escape the pain, and they reach for the meds, Darnell says. Because catastrophizing is such a powerful force on the experience of pain, she says, it seems like a stroke of genius to target it. Darnell took exactly this approach with Angela, a patient who scored very high on QIRE's catastrophizing scale when she first came to the Stanford Clinic. After a traumatic brain injury, Angela had endured years of severe headaches, neck pain, and fibromyalgia, a poorly understood syndrome that includes all-over body pain and fatigue. She was taking opioid painkillers as well as various potent migraine medications, Still, her pain often left her in a wheelchair. It interfered with her ability to care for her children, run her business, and maintain healthy relationships with her husband and parents. Like many chronic pain patients, Angela also mourned the loss of her life before the pain. She used to enjoy a variety of fast-paced sports, activities that now, she says, exasperated, "I can't even imagine." Angela's sense of powerlessness is common, and doctors who dismiss chronic pain because they cannot explain it only compound that feeling. When surgeries or other treatments fail to help, patients learn to expect failure. Patients come to us so demoralized they have been through the mill, Darnell says. Our job is to remoralize them first. The initial step is giving patients back a sense of control, no matter how small. People need to know that their pain is real, it's not their fault, and here are some ways that we can address it, Darnell says. As with all her patients, Darnell invited Angela, along with her family, to a free 2-hour educational seminar to learn about how pain and biopsychosocial factors interact. Angela also received a relaxation CD like the one David was given. Darnell explains to patients in her care that the auditory experience recorded on the CD works to calm the nervous system and that they should think of listening to it as taking a dose of mind-body medicine. Do it regularly. Establish a new pattern, she emphasizes. Even if you can't do 20 minutes, do 5. Doing something is better than nothing. Always, always. Angela started using the CD right away. She also took up yoga, began regular massage therapy, and pursued a specialized pain-focused talk therapy with Darnell. Now, several months later, she has made measurable gains. She has learned to keep her emotions in check during stressful times, which has improved her relationships. Her catastrophizing score is way down. She no longer takes opioids, but instead only a very low dose of naltrexone, a drug that blocks opioid receptors and is thought to reduce inflammation. And she can walk again for several miles at a time, pain-free. Perhaps most significant, she has started to set goals for her future. "I can't dance like I used to, but I can move a little bit," she says with a sly smile. For Angela, who spent years in a wheelchair, thinking she would never move freely again, to dream of dancing is a triumph. And we have time to read something from the Harvard Health Beat by Laura Kiesel, written on April 28, 2017. And this is titled Chronic Pain, the Invisible Disability. Sometime back in 2010, a good friend of mine from college, who had since become a pediatrician, posted a complaint on Facebook about made-up health conditions. "Fibromyalgia, I'm looking at you," she wrote. At this time, pain was more of an occasional visitor in my body rather than the permanent tenant it has still become. Still, I was offended on behalf of those patients with the disease. Fast forward to today, and my life is all about pacing. This is because everything I do, cook, sleep, work, walk, takes time. This gradual approach to every aspect of my life is not about enlightenment or mindfulness. It is about pain, or more specifically, trying to evade or minimize it. To minimize is key because I've learned it can't be avoided, at least not entirely, no matter my effort. For me, fibromyalgia became a default diagnosis, a catch-all phrase the doctors slapped on me to encompass all the aches and health complaints that had begun to persistently plague me. I received this diagnosis even as imaging showed degenerative changes and other damage in my spine and hips, even as endometriosis was confirmed to be spreading like strands of spider web inside my abdomen, wrapping its tendrils around my organs with the insidiousness of an invasive plant. When the pain reached the point of making it impossible to work more than on a very part-time basis most weeks, I began to inquire about disability. But my doctors, the same ones who diagnosed me, treated me, and viewed my MRI results, all shook their heads and refused to sign off on any paperwork. This was the same line I was offered in college after extreme intestinal distress caused me to lose more than 20 pounds in a single semester. But the school nutritionist thought I just wasn't eating enough bananas. You have such shiny, healthy-looking hair, she explained, pinching a lock of it between her fingers as though I were a doll on display. People who are really sick don't have hair like yours. A colonoscopy showed nothing visibly wrong, so the doctor diagnosed me with irritable bowel syndrome and treated me as though I was a hopeless neurotic. Stop being so stressed and eat your greens, he scolded. 2 years later, a laparoscopic surgery would show widespread endometriosis, a large portion of it choking my colon. Its removal eased my GI complications considerably, but by then I had learned the hard lessons that doctors often erred on the side of disbelief when they couldn't see something plainly, or even when they could. I have heard an extensive list of reasons why I can't be in as much pain as I say, despite my test results. And besides my shiny hair, like, I'm too young, I have good teeth, I'm too thin to have back problems. Yet these haven't granted me immunity from illness, and they have not prevented pain. Only recently has medical research started to catch on to what patients suffering from chronic pain have long known. As reported in a New York Times Well column written by Tara Parker Pope in 2011, a study by the Institute of Medicine discovered that pain can endure long after the illness or injury that caused its initial onset has been treated or healed, until it eventually evolves or devolves into its own disease. That is, pain is no longer indicative of another prognosis. It is the prognosis. Specifically, under the strain of prolonged pain, nerves not only become supersensitized to pain signals, but begin amplifying them. Once these changes occur, they can be extremely difficult to undo. Meanwhile, most medical students are woefully lacking in training in chronic pain, usually receiving only a few hours' worth in their entire education. In fact, veterinarians receive more training on how to treat animals in pain than medical doctors do for their human patients. Unfortunately, without an adequate understanding of pain and its mechanisms, many medical practitioners are quick to downplay the experience of their patients as faking or exaggerating. What this translates into is denying a disability because it is invisible to the naked eye. And that was from a Harvard Health Beat article. Thank you for tuning in to Sound Body today. Stay well and come back next week for more healthy living ideas. This has been Sound Body, a production of WXXI Reach Out Radio in Rochester, New York. I'm Louise Craig, and I hope you'll join me again next week for more health updates and information for healthy living. If you'd like to hear this program again, you can download a podcast of the show at our website, wxxi.org.